couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about, I'm not going to be talking about anything new, because there are no new movies. Way to go, Hollywood. I mean, there's some smaller stuff that I didn't quite have access to or I didn't search for, and there's a couple streaming things, but I said, you know what, when Hollywood's going to give me nothing, when it's giving me the lemons, I'm going to make lemonade out of my own thing. So we're going to be talking about a retrospective of some Stephen King movies, some of them that I've not covered. One of them I have, but I want to revisit it. And those movies are going to be Christine, Maximum Overdrive, The Running Man, The Lawnmower Man, and the 1997 TV version of The Shining. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring, and this is what caused me to do the Stephen King retrospective, Stephen King's Thinner on Blu-ray. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's quickly look at the box office and see, not a whole lot happened. Same thing's going to happen this weekend. I think it's going to, because there's no new big movies. The big only new movie that was last week was ISS. That came in at number 7 with just over $3 million. That's not a great number, but you know what? I mean, it was a Bleecker Street release. It was a smaller release. It was not something that I think anyone was going to be expecting to make $20 million. So I'm not going to call that a failure or anything. But yeah, you had Mean Girls at number 1, The Beekeeper at number 2, Wonka at 3, Migration at 4, and Anyone But You at 5. You know what? I have no interest in seeing Anyone But You. I missed it over Christmas. I was gone on vacation, and I have no interest in seeing it. But this is turning into the little movie that could over the holiday season. It's made, it's going to get to probably close to $100 million, or at least $80 million in its run. And nobody thought this was going to do. This thing has never gone above number 3 in the weekend, but it's actually doing quite well for just a little rom-com. So this shows that this is a lesson to Hollywood. If you do a smaller niche movie, you don't have to make $100 million. Part of the reason Anyone But You is being considered a success now. The same thing for Migration too, which is doing quite well in its run. And the reason those are considered successes are simply because they didn't cost $250 million to make. That's the lesson here. Make lower priced movies. Don't make massive lists of movies. Just make reasonably priced movies, and you should be at least in a good situation. The next piece of news I want to talk about is the Academy Award nominations came out this week. So did the Razzies. The Razzies look fine. I mean, the Razzies were about the Razzies. What do you expect? I know there are some people that are like, oh, I don't like punching down. Okay, look, I'm okay with punching down on movies like Shazam Fury of the Gods, which was not very good. The only time I really took issue with the Razzies was when they nominated a kid. And sort of how they really kind of dug into Jake Lloyd back in the late 90s. I mean, Jake Lloyd kind of went bonkers, but I don't think the Razzies helped. But the Oscar nominations are out, and a lot of people are talking about those, so let's kind of give a little look at them. You know, none of these titles are big surprises. You know, the best picture, it's going to be Oppenheimer. Don't we all know it's going to be Oppenheimer? There were no surprises. I thought it was cool Maestro got in there. I think the fact that both The Zone of Interest and Anatomy of a Fall, I think The Zone of Interest is partially foreign language, but I'm surprised that both those popped in there. But I'm also not surprised because I've been seeing a lot of buzz about them. But I think Best Actor, I'd love to see Colman Domingo get it for Rustin, but you know it's going to be, well, probably either Paul Giamatti or Cillian Murphy. It was nice to see Jeffrey Wright get nominated. For Best Actress, again, I think Emma Stone's, it's hers to lose, but I think if Lily Gladstone won, that'd be great. Annette Bening has no reason being there. It's nice to see Carey Mulligan get in there for Maestro. And then for Best Director, I know there's a lot of people that are upset that Greta Gerwig didn't get nominated, but she did get nominated for writing, which is okay. And there's 10 Best Picture nominees and only 5 Best Director nominees. I don't like to throw the word snub around because I don't know which one of these people didn't deserve the Best Director nomination. The fact that I know there's a lot of people that are upset that Margot Robbie didn't get nominated, but Ken got it, which is almost like the story of the movie. Although America Ferrera was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. So, I mean, she's not going to win. I think that's going to be Diane Randolph. I get where people are annoyed at it, but still, you can't say Barbie didn't get nominated for, it got nominated for stuff. And the reason actually Ryan Gosling deserves it is because he really made that role unique. And I mean, Margot Robbie did a great job as Barbie, but the Ken character, there was some nuance and fun, and there was a little bit more weird, like the supporting role flavor stuff that really kind of gets noticed. And you know, I'd love to see him win. Who knows? He might. But you have to remember that while Greta Gerwig didn't get nominated for Best Director, Justine Trait was nominated for Anatomy of a Fall, so it was not without women. And then all the other Best Actress nominations did go to women. So, I mean, it's not like it was really that big of misogyny on play, although it does make a nice little narrative to play around with. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is from Netflix. Actually, both of these are from Netflix, but the first one I want to hit is Avatar: The Last Airbender, which is a new series coming to Netflix on February 22nd.
The Fire Nation is embarked on a dark path, and the world might never recover. The world needs the Avatar. It needs you, Aang.
The Fire Nation has destroyed everything in their path. If the world is going to have any chance, it's going to need Aang.
The most I remember about Avatar: The Last Airbender was the absolutely colossally terrible film adaptation that M. Night Shyamalan did back in whatever that was, 2009, 2010. That thing was just dog crap. It was awful. It was embarrassing. I've not watched much of the cartoon. I've watched a couple episodes of it, but I've not watched much of it. But at least this looks like it's emulating the cartoon much more than the M. Night Shyamalan catastrophe that we had. This one looks like it's trying to do an authentic version of it. And like I said, I've never watched stuff like One Piece, but it seems like Netflix is at least taking some care with this. You know, sure, Death Note, a lot of people complained about, but at least for these types of adaptations, it seems like Netflix is making a point to make what they would want for the fans. The next one I want to talk about is Ripley, which is coming to Netflix on April 4th.
You're a very hard man to find. No address, phone, office.
Tom. Please, Tom.
Tom Ripley.
Tom Ripley?
Thomas Ripley.
I like the name.
Tom what?
Ripley.
This is the same character as The Talented Mr. Ripley, or if, I don't know if it's a remake of it or if it just uses that same character, but Andrew Scott plays the role of Ripley. And if you don't know him, he was in All of Us Strangers this past year. That got him a lot of award buzz, but most people in the rest of the world didn't see it outside of like film buffs. You might recognize him. He was in the show Fleabag. He played the priest that was struggling with his faith and wanted to have a relationship with Phoebe Waller-Bridge's character. But he was also in the Sherlock series with Benedict Cumberbatch. He played Moriarty. He's very good, so I'm very curious to see how this one turns out. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, we're going to be driving into some Stephen King adaptations, Christine and Maximum Overdrive.
Thank you.
Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's kick this into high gear and start talking about the Stephen King adaptations. Like I said, I've talked about many Stephen King films, you know, either current ones that have come out when It came out, or even like stuff like A Good Marriage. I think I even talked about Cell when Cell came out. But I'm going back into the archives, because here's the thing. You have to understand, I'm just going to preface all this by saying I was way too young to read Stephen King, but I started reading Stephen King sometime in, I would say it was like 84. I was about 12 or 13 when I started reading Stephen King's stuff. And I loved it. I read it voraciously. I mean, I devoured Stephen King's books. And you got to remember, you got to think, people think, oh, yeah, big Stephen King. And I'm talking about, like, he was getting ready to publish Skeleton Crew, which I believe was 1985. So it was just the stuff that he had been writing for about 10 years. I mean, I'd read Carrie and The Shining and The Dead Zone. And, you know, there was Christine and Pet Sematary. I think both those came out in 1983. And I read all those. What I got on one of those. I do even have this anymore. The book club, the Doubleday book club. And I got a bunch of book club editions of these. And I just read through all of them. I really loved Stephen King's work. So I've seen a lot of his films. And I mean, I loved it. I thought it was a great movie that Andy Muschietti did several years ago. But my true love of the Stephen King stuff is the stuff from the 80s and some of the 70s. So let's talk about Christine, which is one that it took me years to see. And it's a unique film that's been made of his book. Based on the best-selling Stephen King novel, this film tells the story of a high school outcast who falls in love with his demonic car, a 1958 Plymouth Fury named Christine.
She is pure evil. She is Christine, and nothing you can do can stop her. Because how do you kill something that can't possibly be alive? Christine, body by Plymouth, soul by Satan.
So this movie, its adaptation came very quickly. The book was published in, I think, like the spring of 1983, and the movie came out like that Christmas. It's not a Christmas movie, but it came out like in December. So they jumped on that very, very quickly. And it, outside of Carrie, of like that early run from the 70s into the 80s of his books, this was really his other big high school story. I mean, eventually it was more middle school, but you know, it was in there, but that didn't come until later in the 80s. So this was him playing around with the teen horror, the slasher genre, but instead of having a mass killer, it was a car. I've read the book. The book's really good, but it is definitely him working through some stuff of his own when he was in high school. But the other thing that's fascinating about this one is it's one of those from the 80s that was actually directed by a well-known director. It was directed by John Carpenter, and it was his follow-up to The Thing. And this is an intriguing mix of Stephen King and John Carpenter. It doesn't always live up to the book, but now it really holds up as a relic of 1980s teen horror. It really does fit that mold of the classic slasher movie. And of course, you got to remember, John Carpenter helped create that genre. The movie itself plays better, I think, than it did in 1983, or at least mid to late 80s when I first saw it. It was never one of my favorites. It's not my favorite Carpenter movie. It's not my favorite Stephen King adaptation, even. It's this own little, like, sort of this footnote in the history where it's both Stephen King and John Carpenter with his elements, and the music is done by John Carpenter, so it has that John Carpenter feel to it. And they both love rock and roll so much that it works in there. I think in the run of all the high concept Stephen King stuff, like Haunted Hotel and a cemetery that brings your pets back to life, and a guy who's got psychic powers, with all those relatively high concept, it's just a haunted car movie. And so it kind of played soft when I saw it back in the 80s. But revisiting, and I watched it a couple years ago, and I revisited it again this week. And I gotta say, I appreciated it. I fell for it a little bit more. I mean, it's got all these cliches, but There's an endearing quality to it, and this is one that didn't play as well back then, but I think it holds up better. I'm going to have to say that Christine kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Maximum Overdrive. This is such an anomalous movie because you can learn a lot about and from Stephen King in this movie, even though he didn't mean to teach you anything. So let's play the trailer, which is a bonkers trailer in itself. Stephen King tried his hand at directing this fever dream horror film about machines that gain sentience and rebel against humanity.
Hi. My name is Stephen King. I've written several motion pictures, but I want to tell you about a movie called Maximum Overdrive, which is the first one I've directed.
Wow.
What in the dickens is going on around here?
And who was driving it?
I don't know.
If you know your horror movies well enough, you'll recognize that music is from Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which I gotta love the fact that they played that music during that trailer. And it's not like it was something owned by Dina De Laurentiis. He had nothing to do with Halloween 3, as far as I know. But that's the music they chose for the trailer and licensed for it. And so it's bonkers. And I remember that trailer. It was such a cool trailer because he's there and he's like, I'm going to scare you. And he's pointing at the screen and Stephen King and his goofiest, craziest, sort of psychopathic, coked up nuthouse appearance. One of the best things about this movie, quite honestly, is that Green Goblin truck. That made it iconic. If you didn't have that, it wouldn't look as cool. And it would have been so forgettable. But this movie is an absolute mess. The characters are terrible. The story is nonsensical. The dialogue is bonkers, but it's fully Stephen King bonkers. And I've read the story trucks, which is much more somber. And this is what's so fascinating. This is what you can learn a lot. Stephen King sees movies and books so very differently. If you read his books, they're often deadly serious. They're often very serious and grim and heavy and deal with these dark emotional concepts. But what he likes in a movie is the goofier stuff. That this movie is completely bonkers and goofy and silly. Now, part of it is he was hopped up on drugs through the whole thing. I mean, someone once said to me, Stephen King didn't direct this movie. Cocaine directed this movie. And it certainly shows haphazard and manic, and it has all this pent-up energy but doesn't know what to do with it. And what's funny, I remember wanting to see it when it came to the theaters, and it blew through so quickly because it's such a terrible movie that nobody wanted to see it, especially when it came out. And then I watched it on VHS, and I'm like, this thing's terrible. And over the years, I've rewatched it, and it's still bona fide terrible, but there's an enjoyability about it because it is so bonkers. And what's so funny is I don't think I've ever been at that exact location, but I've been near a truck stop or two like that. Anyways, I mean, Maximum Overdrive, it's a relic, and it's funny, and it's really good to watch when you've, you know, had a couple. It's not a good movie at all. I mean, it totally sucks. But doggone it if it isn't entertaining to watch.
It sucks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Lawnmower Man and The Shining. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We are in our Stephen King retrospective simply because it's January and Hollywood decided not to really give us any major movies this week. And even if they did, they weren't going to screen it for me, that's for sure. You know, it's so funny because as a critic, oh my gosh, the last 3 months of the year, every studio's like, oh, watch my movie. Oh, please, please, please. Here, and then it'll send you, and I have a stack, you know, 2 feet tall of discs that I don't have time to watch. And then it turns January, and I'm like, hey, can I get a copy? And they're like, who? What? No? We're not showing anybody that. The startling chasm of confidence between what they have at award season and want you to watch and what they will release in January is pretty hilarious in this industry. Anyways, let's talk about the next Stephen King movie, or not Stephen King movie. The Lawnmower Man. This is also infamous. I just like telling some of the stories involved with this one. A mentally disabled handyman is given experimental drugs and VR treatments, which expand his mind until he becomes a threat to humanity.
From Stephen King.
Virtual reality holds a key to the evolution of the human mind.
Comes another shock to the system.
There's no telling how far I can take you.
He'll get under your skin.
What are you hiding?
Into your system.
What is it?
And tear you apart.
I am God here.
From Stephen King comes the most terrifying film of the year. The Lawnmower Man. Rated R. Experience it Friday at a theater near you.
You know, I've said that a lot of these are from the 80s. Not all of them. Lawnmower Man is actually from the 90s. I think it was like 91, 92. And when I talk about Thinner, Thinner's from the 90s, as is The Shining TV series. So it's 80s, 90s, but The Lawnmower Man certainly feels very 80s, but it has the 90s technology ideas with virtual reality, which was just being introduced at the time. And one of the best things about virtual reality movies from the 90s is they get it all wrong. They're like, ooh, you're going to have this interface. In fact, one of the seasons of Community, I think when Community fight ended up going on like Yahoo, and they had Jonathan Banks in there and Keith David. And I think Keith David was a guy, an old developer of VR, and he had developed all these VR programs for the 90s that didn't make any sense for use now. But I mean, I remember when VR was being introduced, you're like, oh, this is going to be so cool. And if you tried to present this VR stuff to somebody on an Oculus, they'd be like, what? Anyways, the interesting thing about The Lawnmower Man is it has nothing to do with the original story, The Lawnmower Man. There's literally one scene in the movie where this guy is attacked by a lawnmower that Job, the handyman who is now has superpowers, controls this lawnmower by his brain and he kills somebody with it. And then there's a scene the next morning of the police there and they're like, oh, where's the rest of them? In the bird bath. That's like that line. That's like the only thing from the original story. The original story is about this guy who hires a lawnmower service, and it turns out to be the satyr who worships Pan, and the lawnmower mows the grass, and then he strips naked, completely naked, and runs behind it, eating all the grass clippings. And then it kills the guy. That's basically what the original story, nothing to do with VR, nothing to do with computers at all. You know, Pierce Brosnan isn't, I mean, there is a lawnmower in there. That's like the closest you get. And what's so funny is when The Lawnmower Man came out, and the trailer I played for you is that original TV trailer. That's important because they were like, from the imagination of Stephen King comes The Lawnmower Man. Stephen King's The Lawnmower Man. And he sued to get his name taken off of it. And that's very hard to do. If you've seen enough movie adaptations of books and stories, they can go way off base. But they were so far off base. They had such a completely and totally manufactured story. It wasn't even remotely in any relation to Stephen King stuff. He actually won that lawsuit. He got a cash payment and they were forced to take his name off the product completely. Not just off of the Stephen King's Lawnmower Man, but they had to take it off of like the credits. But it's basically a Jolt Cola and Fruitopia infused 90s version of Flowers for Algernon. And so it kind of has that same story, only in Flowers for Algernon, he doesn't turn into this menace. He just kind of regresses back to his original mental state. But this movie's a lot of fun. I mean, as much as I understand where Stephen King's coming from, I'm like, this isn't a bad movie. There have been worse adaptations of Stephen King's work, some of which he's done himself, referencing Maximum Overdrive from before the commercial. But as unrelatable as it is, it's a fun little 90s thriller. I love the movies about something going on in a lab and there's a problem, and that this falls into that category. And yeah, it's got like 90s kid Austin O'Brien, who was in every movie at that point. But doggone it if I didn't enjoy this one. It's great because it's like Pierce Brosnan slumming it between Remington Steele and James Bond, so he's kind of just picking whatever part he could get at that point. But boy, you know, it's cheesy and it's dripping in 90s silliness, but that VR thriller offers an unnerving, if not completely absurd, cyber thriller. I'm going to say that Lawnmower Man, even without Stephen King's involvement, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about another 90s Stephen King thing, and that is The Shining. This TV miniseries takes a more faithful approach to the adaptation of Stephen King's novel about a haunted hotel.
Our greatest fears are all around us, shrouded in evil, waiting to be unleashed.
You shine on, boy.
Shine on?
The Bible calls it having vision. I can feel it coming off you like heat.
From Stephen King, the creator of It, The Tommyknockers, and The Stand, comes a completely new vision of terror.
Annie. Seize your destiny, Mr. Torrance.
I am a huge fan of Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, and when you compare these two, the scope of Kubrick's The Shining is so much bigger. And I'm not just talking about the insane, impossible geography in The Shining, or the hidden messages and symbolisms and subliminal stuff that he's got in there. This Kubrick version of The Shining is a work of art to be studied. And I understand why Stephen King hates it, because it's flipping him in the bird, especially when you get to the end. But this version of The Shining, I've always wanted to see it. I even remember I taped it off of TV back in 97. I never got around to watching it because it was like 4 hours. And then, it was about 2 years ago, I ended up it was a disc set, a multiple movie set. It had It, the original It from 1990. It had this, may have had something else, but it also had The Salem's Lot with Rob Lowe. So I watched this, and I have to say, I appreciate what he's trying to do. And I respect Stephen King for wanting to have a more authentic version of The Shining. And from what I understand is where he shot this, or where Mick Garris, who's the director of it, where he shot this, was much more accurate to the hotel that Stephen King envisioned and based it on. The Overlook Hotel in the Kubrick version is very different from the version that was in the book. And so I can appreciate that. And there's other things in there. They have these hedge animals. They're hedges that are cut to look like animals, like lions and stuff, and they come to life. And it's not great special effects because it's late 90s made for TV budget. So those don't look great, but I love the fact that they put that in. And they had a more accurate depiction of Wendy. In the book, Wendy was an attractive blonde woman. I believe she was blonde. And they got Shelley Duvall with the worst hairstyle ever. Not that Shelley Duvall can't look okay, but they did not take any effort to make her do so in that. So I can respect it. It follows it better. The kid who played Danny is terrible. Not that the kid who played Danny in the first movie was very good either. I would love to see them remake The Shining as a theatrical with Mike Flanagan as the director, especially after you see what he did with Dr. Sleep and was able to merge both the movie and Stephen King's vision, even though they're at odds with themselves. So, I mean, while this is more faithful to the book, the mid-90s TV movie of the week production value just strips down the horror and human elements. It feels cheap. I'm going to have to say The Shining for TV kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Running Man and the home cinema roundup featuring Thinner. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's wrap up these reviews of the Stephen King retrospective on film, and let's talk about The Running Man. Arnold Schwarzenegger stars as a cop in a dystopian future who defies orders and is thrown into a popular gladiator-style game show on live TV.
In the year 2017, an innocent man accused of a crime has a choice. Hard time or prime time?
Sensational. Perfect contestant. I want him.
He must pay or play the running man.
On your mark!
I'll be back.
Go!
The highest rated TV show in history.
Guess they want us to stay.
The original book, The Running Man, is very different than this. It's more of like the Most Dangerous Game, like that version of that was on, well, it's on Roku now, but it was on Quibi. The original Running Man book was about this guy who and he kind of just has to hide out, and he has these assassins looking for him just in the regular world. This one is much more of a spectacle, but it does follow the idea of a guy running away from stalkers who are coming after him. So, you know, that's why, you know, even with something as off the beaten path as this was to the original story, it's not nearly as completely bonkers as The Lawnmower Man. But what's interesting about this was originally written under the pseudonym Richard Bachman, who is Stephen King's pseudonym. He was getting frustrated because no matter what he wrote, they publish. And so by the time he got to the late 70s, you know, after Carrie had propelled him to fame, you know, several years later, he's like, I wonder if I could do it again. And back then, there were just tons of paperback books, and they were very, very disposable. They sold them at airports and newsstands and everything, and because, you know, people didn't have video games, they didn't have iPhones and everything. You know, they needed something for entertainment, and TV wasn't even that good back then. So he wrote a bunch of books and submitted them completely under a pseudonym to see if he can get them published. And he started to get these paperback books published. And then one of them was called Rage, which was another teen movie, which would not fly now because it's about this kid who walks into his school and shoots his teacher and holds his class hostage. And he did a book called The Long Walk, which is actually kind of an interesting story. About these people who they have to walk and they just have to keep walking, and whoever's the last one standing, they kill everybody who stops, and the last one standing wins. And so there were a lot of them were leaning a little bit into science fiction. The Running Man kind of leans into science fiction. That was him playing around with some science fiction, but there's still the darkness. Another one called Roadwork, which is my least favorite. That was just about a guy who was upset about the construction going on. I understand that, but you could see Stephen King working out some stuff in these. But then he wrote a book called Thinner, which I'll talk about in a little bit. And that one actually did quite well. It was getting there. And he said he never got to the best-selling list, but he thought the next book he was going to put on under Richard Bachman's name would. And his next one was going to be Misery. But then he got found out. And then, of course, his books that maybe sold 2,000 copies, I'm sure if you have an original copy of the Running Man, it's quite expensive. But anyways, they made this movie in the 80s, and they threw Schwarzenegger in, and it's this 80s Schwarzenegger movie. I mean, it's R-rated, it's violent, it has all these muscle men in it, it's got like Jesse the Body Ventura, and it is that late 80s action movie. It's sort of like the early 80s action movie and stuff like First Blood was early 80s, and that was more gritty, and that was a nice action movie. And once James Cameron got involved, you got the Terminator and Aliens, then you started to get these sort of higher budget. I mean, they're still low budget by today's standard, but these science fiction type movies. And this is very quintessentially a Schwarzenegger sci-fi action movie along the lines of like Total Recall. This is a fun movie. It's classic Schwarzenegger. He even has a line. It's in the trailer where he says, "I'll be back." And then also, this is just a stroke of genius. They cast Richard Dawson, and people nowadays don't know who Richard Dawson is. Richard Dawson was the host of Family Feud. He was one of the most recognizable game show hosts of the 70s and 80s. And getting him to play the game show host and basically being a parody of himself was a stroke of genius. You know, I mean, this diverts a lot from the book by Richard Bachman, a.k.a. Stephen King. But this is an entertaining piece of 80s pop action. I really enjoyed it. I remember seeing it in the theaters, enjoying it then. And every time I've watched it, I'm like, yeah, it's stupid, but it's fun. I'm going to say that The Running Man kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. We've been talking about Stephen King this whole time. Why stop now? Let's continue talking about Stephen King, go up into the 90s, and talk about Stephen King's Thinner. I'm saying that the way the gypsy in the movie does when he gives him the curse. Michael Constantine plays him. An overweight and morally corrupt lawyer is struck with a gypsy curse that causes him to lose an uncontrollable amount of weight.
Did you weigh yourself?
297.
Billy, you were 297 last week.
You kill my daughter, and I curse you. Finn.
This diet you're on, what is it?
I don't think you'd like it, Henry.
I'm being erased.
It's all your fault if you hadn't hit that old lady.
Beware the danger.
This is getting out of hand.
This has been out of hand, and I'm just the guy to put it back.
Please, take it off before this goes any further.
I never take it off.
I'm a fat guy, hence the name Fat Guys at the Movies. And I know what it's like to be heavy and then trying to do diets and look, there is a difference, and I always have no respect for people when they're like, "Oh, how dare you? You're just such a pig because you think food is so important." Food is fun, man. I enjoy food. It is a pleasure of life. Yeah, sometimes you have to eat stuff that's gross, or you know, just have to eat to survive. But I love different foods. That's one of the reasons I like going on cruises. You get all these different, you can try all these foods. You go to all these different places and try foods in the ports. And I love to eat. And yes, that's why I'm fat. I'm not a dummy. I know that. I thought they did a decent job portraying a fat guy in this, because of course he's not played by a fat guy. They had to put a fat suit on him, you know, because he eventually has to get skinny in the movie. They didn't make being fat the butt of a joke all the time. But this is less about weight and more about guilt and your acceptance of guilt. And it's funny, I read Thinner, like I said, I was reading all my Stephen King stuff when I was a kid. And I didn't understand what it was like to be a father. I didn't understand what it was like to be a professional. I didn't understand what it was like to meet somebody who was the sleazy type of lawyer. And he's not sleazy lawyer. It's not like he's not Better Call Saul. He's more... He has no scruples. I have a lawyer friend who can find a workaround to anybody's innocence. That's how lawyers are taught to think, even though they're not supposed to ignore facts. But it shows that he's not a nice person. He's not a good guy. The main protagonist is not a good guy. Neither is his wife. But it's so funny because there's such a focus on him blaming her. I mean, I can't explain why he gets in trouble, because basically he's distracted while he's driving and he hits this gypsy lady. And it's the daughter of Michael Constantine's character. And then he curses him because he knows the judge and he knows the sheriff, and they're able to just kind of make the case go away. And I didn't quite understand it because I wasn't married at the time that I read. I didn't even have a girlfriend at the time. I was a kid. And so I just thought it was Stephen King actually saying, no, it was this woman's fault. Just because the main characters think something does not mean that's what the writer's thinking. Does not mean that that's the right thing. And it's interesting because in the special features, there's a whole bunch of interviews with Tom Holland, who directed Fright Night and Child's Play. He directed this movie. So he's all these interviews, and he's such a grumpy old man. I love looking at interviews with him now because he just complains about everything. But they analyze the movie and they look at the different things in the film. And one of the things that he points out is that they had trouble getting the ending right. Now, they still don't quite nail the ending, because the ending that King wrote was not acceptable to the general audience. They didn't like it. It wasn't uplifting. But the main character's not really a good guy. And that's the whole point, is guilt and trying to shove guilt and not accepting your own responsibilities leads to bad things. And that's the message of the book, and that's the message of the movie, too. It just has trouble kind of getting there. But it's still, I mean, the movie itself is, it's a well-made adaptation of King's work, and it balances the body horror with questionable morality. I mean, I think it keeps about 60% of the original message, but it's still fun to watch. It's out on Blu-ray. It's by Shout Factory. It has a whole ton of special features, bunch of interviews with like the director, and it's got interviews with some of the cast members and special effects people. So very worth checking out. You know, I'm going to say that Stephen King's Thinner kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it. I gotta go. Next week I'm going to be talking about Argyle. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.